Time has produced some of the most incredible humans to walk the face of this planet we call home. People who've endured the most harrowing ordeals, pushing their body to the extreme. Whether it's plane crashes, abduction, jungle survival, or even medical anomalies, we explore them all. Who are these people? What happened? Where are they now? Join us to find out.
Not Me, Not Today podcast.
Hey guys, it's Leisha and Kenny here, and welcome back to another episode of Not Me, Not Today podcast.
Hello, and hello to everyone, wherever you are in the world. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm all good, thanks. I'm really looking forward to this week's story. Before we do that though, I just wanted to say that all the support we've had has exploded over the last week. We're so glad you liked last week's tale. So again, thank you all. And also remember, we still want to hear from you, so whatever kind of stories you want to hear in the future, or if you just want to talk about the last few episodes, we'd love to have a chat about that. We'll provide all the necessary links at the end for you. But that just leaves me with one question. Leisha, what's the story?
Today's story is about Tsutomu Yamaguchi. He's the only person to survive the atomic bombs at both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'm also going to say there are some pretty tricky words and names for me to pronounce in this one, and I'll do my best, but it may not be perfect.
Oh, cool. Sounds like a good one. Let's do this.
Okay. So I tried to get information on his early life, but there really wasn't much, so I'll give you all I could find. Tsutomu Yamaguchi was born March 16th, 1916, in Nagasaki, Japan. He went to school, graduated there, and then went on to study engineering. After graduating, he became a naval engineer. He got married and had one child by the time this incident happened. Mr. Yamaguchi and a couple of his colleagues were sent to Hiroshima to produce ships. They went by train in May 1945. I looked this up to get an idea of the distance, and yeesh, they are far. Nagasaki and Hiroshima are 421 kilometers apart. Nowadays, it can take anywhere between 3 hours 13 minutes to 5 hours 9 minutes by train. But back then, trains weren't as fast, so it took a little bit longer. Most of the day, in fact. The plan was that they all would stay there for 3 months, and it ended up being a little bit longer. Their company had accommodation for them in the form of a dormitory, where they stayed for the time.
That's unusual.
It is. I mean, it may be more common than we think, but it's just I've never really heard of it. I figured they would have a hotel for them or something. Anyways, I wanted to give you an insight into Hiroshima since that's where the first bomb takes place.
Okay, cool.
Hiroshima was originally a small fishing village along the coast of Hiroshima Bay back in 1589. It became popular and a bustling little village. It has a long, complex history during the times of its different rulers. And during World War II, there were a lot of air raids in Japan. Most particularly in Tokyo, and it caused a heck of a lot of death and destruction, causing thousands of innocent civilians to die. One of the cities that didn't have this problem and escaped the relentless bombings was Hiroshima. But they weren't resting on those laurels, and the threat to Hiroshima was still real. They actually had young children from the ages of about 11 to 14 demolish houses and build fire breaks.
That stops the fire from spreading, right?
Yeah. A fire break is a clearing of vegetation like trees and stuff to slow or stop the spread of fire. More typically wildfire, which would happen when bombs being dropped weren't landing on buildings.
Wow, can you imagine kids today doing that?
It wouldn't happen. But again, this was a time of war, so maybe it would, who's to say? But anyways, on Monday, August 6th, 1945, Mr. Yamaguchi and his colleagues were on their way to work. The route they took to work was really nice. There was a field of sweet potatoes they would walk through on their way every morning. Shortly after they left, Mr. Yamaguchi realized he forgot something back in the dorm. So he decided to head back and get it, telling the other two to go on ahead of him. There was no sense in them all being late. So he got back to the dorm, collected the forgotten item, and made his way back to work. As he was passing through the sweet potato fields, he heard a droning sound in the distance.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. So the droning noise was that of planes. These planes were the B-29 Superfortress, US Air Force bombers that appeared over Hiroshima. There weren't very many planes, and as a result, the air raid sirens weren't sounded.
Oh no, not good. And rush hour.
Uh-huh. First, he noticed an instrument drop out of the plane with a little parachute attached. This instrument was actually to measure the impact of the bomb. Then just a few minutes later, Little Boy was released. Little Boy was the code name for the nuclear bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. It was 8:15 a.m. when the bomb was dropped, and it exploded approximately 600 meters above the city. It was like nothing the world had ever seen. It pretty much vaporized everything below it and caused unbelievable carnage for miles. It instantly killed 70,000 people.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that many.
Oh, yeah. But obviously we're dealing with radiation and that's not instant. So by the time the radiation poisoning deaths were taken into account, along with the other countless other injuries suffered by people in the blast zone, it rose to about 100,000. It even suspected to be higher, I saw in some places, about 166,000 people killed by the end of that year. Of those people, 20,000 were Korean laborers and 20,000 were also military. 70% of the buildings were obliterated and 7% suffered pretty severe damage.
I know it was nuclear, but from one bomb, that is crazy.
Yep.
Did the plane that dropped it get away alive?
Yeah, it did. The name of the plane was Enola Gay. So I'll actually just go through that before moving on because it's pretty interesting. And whilst a lot of our listeners will know this, there may be some who don't. I mean, I didn't know all the details before I started this, so I'll share the stuff that I thought was relevant and interesting.
Okay.
So the Enola Gay was piloted by Colonel Paul Tibbets. The plane was named after his mother. They flew 9,955 meters into the air with the target below them. The bomb was actually armed during the flight to minimize the risk of it going off and killing them all on takeoff. When it dropped, it took 53 seconds from plane to detonation, which remember was 600 meters above the city. The Enola Gay traveled 11.5 miles, which is 18.5 kilometers, and although buffeted by the shockwaves of the blast, the plane remained undamaged.
Wow.
Yep. So anyway, I just want to share that info before we moved back to Mr. Yamaguchi. So when he was on his way back to work, going through the sweet potato field, it went off. And when it went off, it was pretty much a bright flash in the sky. Then he blacked out. He was brought back to consciousness by a searing pain he described as a branding iron on his flesh. He woke up to a world that was unrecognizable from the one just seconds ago. He pushed himself to his hands and knees and tried to comprehend what had just happened. There was a loud ringing in his ears that he'd never experienced before. A sharp pain pierced his left ear. He looked up and saw a crown of fire and a big mushroom cloud soar high into the sky. He actually thought it was the end of the world. The trees and fields around him were messy and disturbed. He struggled to walk. His skin was burnt and red. Radiation burn. He decided not to just stand and wait, but to walk and find help. As he walked, he came across a woman who was also red and burned. Her clothes had literally been blown off her body, and she was naked, burning, and crying. Mr. Yamaguchi had been 3 kilometers away from the hypocenter. Very few people within that radius survived. Due to the explosion and the nuclear fission, the heat was insane. Thousands of degrees Celsius in the city after the explosion.
Oh yeah, you don't think of that, do you? The residual heat, especially nuclear heat.
I know, I never really thought of it either, and it just never really occurred to me. I don't know why. But he was really badly burned, and as were many people. His left arm in particular was bad, and the skin began to slough off.
Ouch.
Yep. Whilst walking to find help, going slowly because he's just survived a nuclear bomb, he came across 3 boys who don't look too great either. They were also burned, red, injured, and their shorts were smoking. They rested together to catch their breath and regain any strength they might have had left. As they sat, it began to rain. But this was no ordinary rain. This rain was black with radiation. It soaked them and it burned. The boys slowly began to suffer from their radiation poisoning and they would cry out for water, suddenly being overcome by an all-consuming thirst. But When they drank the water, they suddenly convulsed and died. And there was nothing Mr. Yamaguchi could do.
Apart from making notes to self to not drink any water.
Exactly. Eventually, he actually manages to find his two colleagues. They'd gone ahead, but it wasn't very far. So, after expressing the relief that they were all alive, they got on a company boat and head back to the dormitory that they'd been staying in.
Well, they weren't going to head into the explosion, were they?
Well, exactly. The city was on fire. So, that night, when they got back, they just watched as the city was reduced to ashes before their very eyes. They decided that night to head back to Nagasaki. They were actually all due to return the next day anyway, and it just happened to be the last day of their trip.
That is crazy. Such bad luck.
Isn't it? It's awful. So, the next morning, Mr. Yamaguchi and his colleagues made the trip to the train station to catch an evacuation train. They walked through the city through remains and rubble. The city had been flattened and fires still burned. The temperatures had dropped, but it was still hot. Again, they at this time didn't know it was a nuclear bomb. It was the first of its kind. So walking back into a concentrated area of nuclear radiation wasn't even a danger to them because they had no idea what they were walking into. Mr. Yamaguchi's left arm was badly burned from the blast, and as he walked, it bubbled and festered beneath makeshift bandages.
After seeing Chernobyl, the show, I can picture the radiation burn so much better. Apparently that was really accurate, that show.
It was a really good show. And it was pretty graphic too. And this is about to get even more so. This next part, I saw Mr. Yamaguchi talk about in a documentary, which I'll let you know where to find at the end. But in the documentary, he told of walking through the city and finding people standing where they were, with the skin of their forearms hanging off like loose ladies' gloves.
Oh, that is so grim.
Brutal. So, anyway, they're walking through the city and there is a river they need to cross to get to the station. But the river was literally filled with hundreds of charred corpses. Mr. Yamaguchi emotionally described them as a raft of bodies that rose and lowered with the tide. He initially thought to take to the water to cross it and reach the station. However, his colleagues advised him against that, considering the state of his arm. It was pretty likely it would infect his burns. So they decided to find another way, even if it took longer. As they progressed through the city, one of his colleagues got separated from them, but they pressed on, and after 5 long hours, they found a railway bridge. On the other side of that railway bridge was the station, and their train to Nagasaki, and what they thought would be safety. Maybe not true safety, but it is relative to that. Anyway, the bridge was a big challenge for them. It was 200 meters long and 15 meters above the river of dead that clumsily flowed below. They were also pretty badly injured, burned, thirsty, and exhausted. But eventually, they got on the train.
Did they find their third friend again?
I don't actually know. It didn't say. I couldn't find any articles on it, but I did look.
Oh, okay.
So, Mr. Yamaguchi got on the train and managed to get a seat. But it had been 24 hours and his burns were starting to get infected and he ran a fever. The burns on his face filled with pus and wept down his neck onto his shirt. He finally made it home, but it wasn't all puppies and rainbows. He had been badly burned and his wife was horrified by it all. She tended to his wounds and tried to help with his fever. And this is where the story becomes even more bananas.
Okay, I'm ready.
So, the next day, against his wife's wishes, Mr. Yamaguchi went into work in the bandages to explain what had happened to his bosses and co-workers.
Did they not know?
See, this is where it's interesting. No, they didn't. They knew that there was a bomb, but they didn't know much more than that.
How would it not be all over the news?
Well, if you and I have learned anything about radiation, it's that when there's a leakage or misuse, governments try to keep that stuff hidden and tend to be pretty tight-lipped about it. This was one of those times. This was the first time. They tried to keep the extent of the blast hidden and information to a minimum. That information was that there had been a big bomb dropped on the city. All details of wiping out an entire city in one fell swoop was kept secret from the rest of the country.
Well, to be fair, the mass panic that would cause, that any moment your city could be wiped out with destruction you never even fathomed possible.
Oh yeah, I do get it. So when Mr. Yamaguchi went into work, his co-workers were all wanting the details of what had happened, surprised to see him showing up at all. He told them about the bomb and the destruction it caused, and his journey back to the station to board that train. And get this, his colleagues didn't believe him. They said that there was no way one bomb could wipe out an entire city. He must be concussed and delirious. But as he protested his story was true, there was another bright flash, rumble, then he was unconscious.
No way, as he tells them about it.
Yup. And in case you're still wondering, that bright flash and rumble was in fact the second nuclear bomb detonating. So this is where I'm going to talk a little bit about Nagasaki and the bombing itself before I go back to Mr. Yamaguchi's experience.
Okay.
Nagasaki started off as a little coastal fishing village in the 1500s that, with the help of Portuguese travelers, really grew and opened up to trade. Over time, it became a largely industrial city home to companies like Mitsubishi Steel and Arms Works and Akinoda Engine Works, along with many other factories and Mitsubishi factories. The population at the time was estimated to be 263,000 people. The code name for this atomic bomb was Fat Man. And the plane that dropped it this time was the same type of plane, the B-29 Superfortress.
You've got to wonder who comes up with the names of these planes. Like, a man somewhere at some point has approached his colleagues or his boss and said, I've got a cool name for a plane, guys, a cool model, the Superfortress.
Sounds like a five-year-old naming his hero's headquarters or something.
Yeah, it's something I would have named my toys back in the day.
Well, the name of the plane was actually Boxcar. So I also learned something new researching this that I probably should have already known, but hey, here we are. Anyway, the second nuclear bomb that went off in Nagasaki was not the initial intended target. Fat Man was actually destined for a city called Kokura. They actually flew to the city with the intention to bomb it at 9:45 a.m. But as they got there and went over the city, the weather was poor and cloud cover was thick.
Oh wow, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, and it had been firebombed the day before, so the smoke from residual fires added to the lack of visibility. And something I found even more interesting is a steel plant in Yahata, which was a nearby city, had actually set fire to the coals to help create a thick black smoke to cloud the view from enemy planes. It was so bad that they couldn't see and didn't want to waste a bomb like that one and risk it not hitting the city. So they decided to head to the target number two, which was Nagasaki.
Wow, what a change of fate for so many people.
The decision to light those coals was monumental to them. So the Boxstar, piloted by Charles Sweeney, headed over to Nagasaki, which was 20 minutes away, and arrived at 10:50 a.m. But when they got there, the visibility also wasn't great. They tried to hold on for a break in the weather, but they were running short on fuel. A sudden little break in cloud cover allowed them to visualize a racetrack below, and that was good enough for them. They dropped the bomb at 11:01 a.m. It took 53 seconds to detonate and exploded at 11:02 a.m. on August 6th, 1945. This time, it detonated 550 meters above the industrial valley part of the city. Again, it was breathtaking carnage. It instantly killed 35,000 people. A lot of those were workers working in the plants and industrial areas below. 60,000 were injured.
My brain struggles to fathom that level of destruction.
Mine too. And apparently the bomb was supposed to be more powerful than Little Boy in Hiroshima. But because of the place they dropped it, the landscape somewhat protected half the city, so the destruction wasn't as much as the Americans were anticipating.
Wow.
Wow indeed. I'll take us back to Mr. Yamaguchi. He was in the office telling his co-workers about the bomb in Hiroshima when the second nuclear bomb exploded. When he regained consciousness, it was a mess. The windows had been blown in, there was paper and sand and dust everywhere. The bandages on his face and arms that he'd been wearing had disappeared. The wounds beneath were once again raw, burning and weeping. Mr. Yamaguchi was in shock as he stared out the window and witnessed in the distance a mushroom cloud, identical to the one he'd seen just 3 days prior.
Can you imagine? You'd never feel safe again, the PTSD that would bring. I can't even imagine it.
I couldn't imagine how you'd cope with that. But again, there were fires everywhere. The city centre was hot with nuclear energy. It began to rain. Black rain. That was thick and greasy. The city was reduced to rubble and fire. Again, unaware it was a nuclear bomb, in the days following, people went out looking for food, commuting larger distances than usual. This brought many to the city for supplies, only to be exposed to radiation they didn't even know was there.
I'm sure there were side effects happening to the people long after the fires had been put out.
Yep, and Mr. Yamaguchi's wife was one of them. She would often go into the city to get food for the family, unwittingly exposing herself to the radiation. A few months later, she came down with a fever and had to be hospitalized. She tended to suffer with increasing health issues, and she later got colon cancer. And as we also know now with this and Chernobyl, births are affected. Mr. Yamaguchi's wife became pregnant in 1948. I just want to throw this in just to tie up a loose end. The war ended on September 2nd, 1945, after the bombs were dropped, because nobody's messing with that. She became pregnant with Mr. Yamaguchi's second child. However, she was terrified of something being wrong because a little girl told her that all the babies being born recently had deformities and problems.
That must have been so scary, especially since it was before the ultrasounds and things like that.
And proper prenatal care. I'd probably be too afraid to be pregnant. Well, anyway, she had the baby and it was actually okay. She and Mr. Yamaguchi went on to have 3 children in total. Jobs weren't easy to come by shortly after the bomb because, well, there wasn't an office to go to, and they made him redundant. So he went off to work labour jobs to make a living and pay for his family. But after a few years, he got a job teaching English at a local junior high school. His wife wasn't the only one who suffered health problems as a result of radiation exposure. Mr. Yamaguchi suffered a lot too. After all, his exposure was at the bare minimum twice as bad as his wife's. He lost his hair, the wounds on his face became septic, and it took years for the wounds to settle down and heal. He felt pain in those wounds every day for years. Life was not easy for Mr. Yamaguchi socially. He suffered from discrimination in work and life.
What? Why?
Well, because they suffered from poor health, so it wasn't appealing to employers. And then some even experienced it in marriage because they thought that the issues caused by the radiation could be passed down.
That is so sad. It's not their fault, though.
I know, it's heartbreaking. I'm also going to say that there is a name given to those who survived the nuclear bombing. They're called the Hibashka, and there are approximately 650,000 of them. However, Mr. Yamaguchi is the only person to have survived both.
Wow, that really is crazy. The sole survivor.
Yep. So I'll talk a little bit about his later life now. Mr. Yamaguchi, for years, never wanted to talk about or even write about his story for a really, really long time. Eventually, when he was 58, he considered that when he retired, he would do public speaking, talking about what had happened to him. But his family weren't pleased about it because, remember, they suffered discrimination, and Japan is all about respect and, at the time, fitting in. This would draw too much attention to them. And there were people with worse injuries than what he had to overcome. They also feared that if people knew you could survive 2 nuclear bombs, maybe they'd drop more. They discussed it as a family, and it was decided best for him not to say anything. So he kept his mouth shut and told no one of his ordeal. His release came in the form of poetry. Again, I will talk about where to get that at the end because he did publish them. He spent his later years with health issues, travelling Japan and writing poetry until he was 89 years old. This is when he suffered another heartbreaking incident that would change the last few years of his life.
More heartbreak?
I'm afraid so. So when Mr. Yamaguchi was 89 years old, his son died of systemic cancer. He was beyond devastated and absolutely convinced it was due to the radiation they'd been exposed to when he was just a few months old.
How old was the son?
I couldn't find the exact age, but it was in his late 50s.
So what did he do after that?
Well, he was so convinced that it was the radiation that he couldn't hold his silence in anymore. For so long, he'd been wanting to tell the world what happened as a survivor of both nuclear bombs. Especially since he was still alive at almost 90, he felt it was for a reason and wanted to spend his remaining years telling the world of the horrors and essentially campaigning for nuclear weapons to stop.
Wow, fair play to him.
Yeah, wow. And to be honest, I can't begin to explain to you what it's like to watch this man and recant his tale and read his poetry.
How did his family take him speaking about it then?
Well, actually this time they were much more okay with it. One of his daughters said that she had agreed with her brother, who passed away, that they must support their dad in telling a story no matter what.
Oh, that's cool.
It is indeed. So he decided to release his poetry. He'd been writing poems since his retirement about the bombs, so he released them. They are heartbreaking. And in the documentary I watched, I cannot begin to explain to you the pain in that man's soul. Watching him, you can see his soul hurts so badly, his body has no choice but to let out stifled whimpers. Like he's talking normally, and then this sorrow tries to break free, and he collects himself and then returns to speaking as though it never happened. If you watch it and you aren't moved, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead inside. I've never seen pain in a human like that before, and I've watched a lot of true crime documentaries.
I think you'll have to show me that after this. It sounds like a really powerful documentary.
Oh, it really is. It's one of the more powerful ones I've watched, to be honest, because of his raw emotions. Anyway, I'm getting slightly off topic, so I'm going to bring it back.
Okay, let's bring it back.
The first time speaking about this incident was to a local high school in Nagasaki, and it was a lot of writing, 90 pages in total, and it took him 2 hours to read them. Now, Japan is all about their elders and respect for the elderly generation, especially those that went through the war. So with the bombings of Nagasaki being such an impactful part of their history, having survivors talk to students is actively carried out and encouraged in Nagasaki. So the first class he spoke to were actually a peace club, and it lasted 2.5 hours. These were his closing words to them. Some people died as they searched for water. Children burned black, couldn't even cry or close their eyes. Some people who managed to escape death were left with indelible and incurable scars on their hearts. They are still suffering from residual disorders, and they are threatened by death because of the A-bomb. Many people bore a regrettable death. Each one of you must learn from the events of the past and think how important peace is. We should never give up working for eternal world peace. I promise to do my best as long as I live. I, Sutomo Yamaguchi, a 90-year-old A-bomb survivor, wish to hand my life over to you. And to be quite honest with you, I bawled my eyes out when he said that because it's really hard to watch him say it.
Wow. I'm sure you could hear a pin drop after that.
Well, if I was there, you wouldn't hear anything but my blubbers. So, after such a positive response, he realized he would need to get people who were more important to listen if he had any hope of trying for world peace or the removal of nuclear weapons. So, he went to the United Nations and gave a shorter version of his speech there.
Whoa, at 90, that's tremendous.
Isn't it? So, he gave a speech to the UN in 2006. He also received his first passport for the venture.
Wow, he'd never been out of Japan before.
I imagine not. Don't know why, but maybe he had no desire to go anywhere. But it was held in New York, which made him uncomfortable. I mean, to him, it's enemy territory. He knew those working now had nothing to do with it, but you can't blame him for not being a big fan of America. They were showing a documentary film there about the A-bomb victims. I'm going to share a little part of that speech because if you don't watch the documentary, I feel it's important to hear his plea somewhere. A Japanese proverb says, what happens twice will happen three times. However, a third atomic bombing must never happen. Please, lend me your strength to eliminate nuclear arms. Regardless of the color of your skin or the language, we all wish to live in peace, without war. Regardless of who wins, war produces many casualties and it plunges bereaved family members into deep sorrow. All for one one for all. If we work hand in hand with this motto, we can surely create a great strength to find ways to avoid war. They were grateful for his story and said that they would try, but the UN discusses the issues and it doesn't really have the power to do much but pass those pleas along to other countries.
The United Nations was created in October 1945 after the war. Random bit of trivia there.
Thank you, I didn't actually think to look that up.
Seriously, although at 90 to give a speech to the UN, that is incredible.
It's so inspiring. He felt that it wasn't even enough. He decided to use the remainder of his life to tell as many people as wanted to listen. Talking one-on-one with anyone who would like to listen to his story and talk about it. School kids doing projects, an American graduate student, an American peace activist too. He spoke to a group of American students who were visiting and touring the Atomic Bomb Museum in Nagasaki. He was a bit nervous about speaking to them because he knew that they'd been taught it was a justified act. They were given a tour of the museum first to see the artifacts and grasp some of the reality of the catastrophic event. He then gave his speech to them. He also gave it in English, a language he hadn't really spoken in 30 years, and it was received incredibly well. They left touched and inspired, and to be honest, I lost it after that speech too.
Okay, you're definitely going to have to show me this afterwards.
I will. In 2009, Mr. Yamaguchi became sick with cancer and refused any life-prolonging treatment, not even cancer treatment. He had his last interview at his bedside, as he tried to speak to as many people as possible, knowing his days were numbered. He passed away on January 4th, 2010, at the old age of 93. I even have his final words. Why do we have to deliver an anti-nuclear message to the world? It is not logistics, but the truth that should be pursued. It must be the belief. If you wanted to watch the documentary, which I really recommend, you can catch it on Netflix. It's called Twice. His book of poetry, which I'm definitely going to get myself now, is available on Amazon. It's called And the River Flowed as a Raft of Corpses, The Poetry of Tsutsumo Yamaguchi. There's also another book about the A-bomb survivors, which includes Mr. Yamaguchi's story called The Last Train from Hiroshima by Charles R. Pellegrino. And yeah, that's pretty much all there is for the story of Tsutsumo Yamaguchi.
Wow, that was such a great story. Really sad as well. I'm looking forward to watching the documentary too now. Thanks for another great tale. Well guys, as usual, you can check out any of the photos we have on our Facebook and Instagram pages. Head over to Not Me, Not Today Podcast. You can also get us on Twitter at Not Me, Not Today PC.
As per usual, you can send us your survivor suggestions to notmenottodaypodcast@gmail.com.
You can also head over to our website, notmenottodaypodcast.com. But until next week, stay alive. Bye.
Not Me, Not Today Podcast.